kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Lot to share. Rosemary is good for remembrance. Science confirms the wisdom of the ancients. A health report that talks about what is the number one problem in America today for the average person. It's their health. Also, the omega-3 fatty acids lessen the severity of osteoporosis. And what you eat may affect your biological internal clock, which means if you eat bad food, you could end up not being able to sleep. So we'll talk at that issue and a lot of others. From our environmental segment today, Las Vegas is really in trouble. The drought drains Lake Mead to its lowest level since the Hoover Dam was built. I'll share the latest on this from Tyler Durnham from Zero Hedge. The statistics are just staggering. So we're looking at really, right now, severe situations. And then also from our environmental segment today, we're going to look at record-shattering ultraviolet radiation levels finally confirmed. This is from Geoengineering Watch. And it shows that solar ultraviolet measured in South America is at dangerous levels. So let's just say that right now you go out into the sun, you go to the beach, you enjoy yourself, feels good. You're able to tolerate, you wear a sunscreen, and the measurement is around 8, maybe 9 on the index of ultraviolet radiation. Now, 11 is considered extreme. Right now, we're seeing 26 reached. We have measured an index of 43, and that means that you simply could not, would not, want to be outside when it reaches 30 to 40. But it is reaching 30 to 40. That means that people are not even aware of the intense radiation that they're being exposed to. Global warming and the loss of our ozone level, that's what's causing it. I'll deal more with that. From short issues today that I'm going to ask you to call in and ask, share your thoughts. From Chris Chan, LinkedIn, why I quit Facebook, and we are sharing much more than you think. It's a short piece. Separately, from Kelly O'Meara, psychiatric drug statistics, over 275,000 babies aged 1 day to 1 year are given psychiatric drugs. The statistics are alarming. Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, 26,406 babies. Ritalin, Adderall, Concerta, 1,422 babies. Antipsychotic drugs, Risperdal, Seroquel, Zyprexa, 654 babies. Xanax, Clonopin, Ativan, 249,669 babies. Why are our babies being diagnosed with mental illness and issued psychiatric drugs under a year old? A, there's not a single piece of scientific literature that is credible in the world that can determine that a baby has psychosis or ADHD or any of these other stupid diagnoses that aren't real to begin with. It doesn't exist. That means that we have an awful lot of very incompetent, misguided, or greedy doctors. Shame on them. They shouldn't be practicing medicine. I'd like your thoughts about this, because this is just another very profitable income stream for Big Pharma. They control literally 100% of the FDA, U.S. Public Health Service, the White House. They are so powerful, and the media doesn't touch them, including the media, much of it on the left, won't touch them. Your thoughts on that? I'd like to hear from you a little later on when we go to our phones. In the second part of our program today, we're going to have conversations with remarkable minds. Hence, all the segments in the first half will be shorter, because I want to give Professor Sheldon Krimsky a lot of opportunity to talk about the deceptions behind GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and why food and chemical companies and government agencies are putting families and the environment at risk. He is the Lenore Stern Professor of Humanities and Social Science at Tufts University, and he has a lot of background. He's one of the leading insider academics in America, and he is speaking out challenging GMOs. Also today, I believe that we should be motivated by positive, inspirational insights from Rinpoche, the jewel you carry with you. Something inspirational. And then I will do part two of my challenge to the producer of the documentary on capitalism. So we will deal with that. Anything I can't deal with today, I'll be on doing it on my next show. Let's begin. From Medical News Today, a new report. This is from Harvard School of Public Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They polled and found that the role of stress in America's lives is about half of the public, in half the public, and that they've had a major stressful event in the last year. And it's related to their health. More than half of those who experience a great deal of stress in the past month or so say that it's because of financial problems, and but it also has to deal with health problems. Quote, it is not widely recognized how many Americans have a major stressful event over the course of a year or how often health problems are the cause. Stress touches everyone. Unfortunately, many of those feeling the most stress get trapped in cycles they cannot deal with and are very unhealthy. If you're going to build a culture of health in America, one big step we can take is recognize the causes and effects, not just on our own stress, but the stress of those closest to us. That recognition can go a long way in helping us create healthier environments in our homes, workplaces, and community, end quote. So here's the takeaway message. We live in a society where inequality is rampant, where misinformation is disguised as good information, but it's nothing more than propaganda. The foods we eat, the water and beverages that we drink, the way that we occupy our time, much of this contributes to adverse health. It also, for a lot of people, contributes to unhealthy children. We have an epidemic of obesity and diabetes and arthritis and heart disease in children and tooth decay. We also can hyper-agitate our genes with the kind of chemicals we put in our body. And then it's completely normal today to take some form of medication to alter our perceptions, our feelings. We are a nation hooked on medications and a lot of pain-killing medications, because when you're on the pain-killing medications, I've counseled a lot of people who have been on them. The reason they can't get off is because they feel so blissful when they're on them, and they don't like how they feel when they're not. So you have to compete with that. So that in turn leads to stress. People know that there's something wrong when they're out of shape, overweight, have pain, but they feel helpless because they don't have the coaching, the partnerships for health that are necessary to give them a hand when they need it. That's why this radio show and your extension of that radio show's message to the friends and people you have, get the message, share the message. But at least it's there. And then the stress that comes from our society today, and we're not focusing on that at all. Now, I've been monitoring all the major programs every day on MSNBC, CNN, Fox. That's painful, but I do it. And I just haven't seen so many dumb people in one place in my life. And so programmed, they're like robots over there. With the exception of Shepard Smith, they just And they're not stupid intellectually. They're just so programmed. But so too are the people on MSNBC. It's painful to watch all this. But I want to see what they're talking about. And they're talking about the same issues, just from different perspectives, right, left. No one, for example, is talking about the impact of stress upon our health, how we get stressed, how we can relieve the stress, how we get sick, how we can relieve the sicknesses, how we can prevent them. They don't deal with the issues that are really fundamental and important to all of us. Another health issue is the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, I keep sharing more and more studies because there are thousands on it. If you have osteoarthritis, and millions do, according to the latest research from Duke University study, this could make a big difference. This was published in the Annals of Rheumatic Disease. Quote, omega-3 fatty acids lessen severity in osteoarthritis in this laboratory experiment. So get your omega-3s every day. Also, what you eat may affect your body's internal biological clock. This is from Japan, from Yakushishi University, and it says, quote, food not only nourishes the body, but also affects its internal biological clock, which regulates the daily rhythm and many aspects of human behavior and biology. Researchers reporting in the Cell Press journal Cell Reports provide new insights into how adjusting the clock through dietary manipulation may help patients with various conditions that impact insulin and also sleep. Now, here's the takeaway message. Though I'm on the road and have about another 5 weeks to go, I still try to reach out to the people who need help each day. And I was giving some counseling to a person who has very bad eating habits and as a result has insomnia and gas and bloating and local pain and puffiness. And I've got him on a program now for the last month, and they've seen remarkable changes for the good. And I call it the grazing program. It's really simple. You start the day with a small amount of nutrition, maybe a health smoothie. In that 16-ounce glass, you'll put your plant proteins, polyphenols through fruits, your greens, and omegas, coconut oil, and fiber, handful of nuts, and then you drink that over about a two-hour period. You don't just gulp it all down. Then a little later in the morning, let's say 2 hours later, you have an apple. Apples are great for you. In fact, one of the best things in the world you can do. I mean, absolutely one of the top things in nutrition. If you peeled apples, 4 or 5 apples, and ate the skin of those organic apple peels, because that's where 90% of the nutrition is, not the flesh. You can use the rest of the flesh for juicing, but it's the apple skin, the peel, that's so good for you. But that's important. That's grazing, but nothing more. Then maybe a little later, you have yourself a red or yellow, purple, or brown sweet pepper. Put some lemon juice on it, a little Himalayan sea salt. It's delicious. Then maybe you have, a couple hours later, maybe a guacamole or gazpacho, or a tomato. With tomato, you can juice fresh tomatoes with garlic and onion and horseradish and pepper and cayenne. It's delicious. Great for you. And then you have one meal a day. Sea vegetables, starchy vegetables, nice green salad, a grain, and legumes, and a normal serving size. And then later in the evening, when you start to feel hungry, you can have organic popcorn that won't impact your blood sugar. Or you can have, as long as within 3 hours going to sleep, you could have a piece of fruit. Let's say a mango, which is one of the great fruits in nature, or papaya. Now, you can add any other combinations of food. The key is you're grazing. You're never overeating. You're not putting a whole lot of food into your metabolism at once. So all day long, you're going to feel light, yet you won't feel hungry. If you're taking a couple juices a day, that's great too, because that's going to give you some energy as well. you're going to lose weight, gain energy, and have healing nutrients going through your system. So this person's lost 24 pounds, gained muscle, complexion cleared up, no more bloating, gas, constipation, the digestive itis gone, no more bad breath. All of this from the simple process of grazing. Just call it like a grazing eating program. Lots of living foods, lots of raw foods. Just get away from this absolutely foolish notion of sitting down to 3 square meals a day, yeah, and die. It is barbaric, it is stupid, it is just insane. And everyone who practices and promotes it is simply putting people in the wrong direction. We need good science. Don't overwhelm your metabolism. You also help maintain a more normal blood sugar and blood pressure. Finally, rosemary, according to the latest science, is really underused, underappreciated. Wasn't it William Shakespeare who said, there's rosemary, that's for remembrance? So for hundreds of years, rosemary has been used. Even Greek scholars, according to Sayer G. of GreenMed Info, recognized the importance of helping your memory. And it's native to the Mediterranean. The ancient Greeks revere it for stimulating the brain and assisting memory. And legends throughout history have written about rosemary. So if you have cognitive problems, use rosemary. In fact, the Journal of Medicinal Food had an article, short-term study on the effects of rosemary on cognitive function in the elderly population, and showed it was very important. So get your rosemary in each day. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to share the insights into information that generally doesn't get covered in most of the other media. Now let's take a look at a short piece on the environment, and this is about Las Vegas. Just 2 weeks ago, Bloomberg's James Nash reports about 55% of Nevada, by the way, I've mentioned many times, it's the nation's driest state, is under extreme or exceptional drought conditions. Now, just so you understand, that's the worst that you could be in the United States, and that's the worst that the U.S. Drought Monitor recognizes. It's never been worse. Why is this important? Because Lake Mead, the man-made reservoir that supplies 90% of the water for 2 million people in Las Vegas area, has been reduced by drought to the lowest level since it was filled in 1937. According to federal government, quote, it concerns us all very much, they say, because it's a resource for 3 states. Let me put it very simply. The shortfall is endangering water supplies to the residents of 43 million annual visitors to the driest metropolitan area in the country. Now, I've discussed this in detail on previous programs. Lake Mead, the man-made reservoir, supplies 90% of the water in that area. It's running out of water. The lake right now is at 39% of capacity. That's it, 39%. So it's 61% dried up. And that has been dropping precipitously since 2012, according to the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation data. The shortfall is endangering all those visitors in the entire metropolitan area. Now, Lake Mead, created by the Hoover Dam in 1936 and 37, holds mountain snowmelt from the Colorado River for farms and homes and businesses, predominantly in southern Nevada and southern California and most of Arizona. No metropolitan area depends on the lake more than Las Vegas, which lacks groundwater. I mean, Las Vegas just dry as a bone. So it's concerning. Now, the lake's surface, which reaches a high of 1,225 feet above sea level, is so low down that the input and output valves are going to be below the water level, which means just like a swimming pool. Imagine your swimming pool drops below the filtration intake valve. Then you can't filter your water. That's what's happening. So now they're drilling through rock to create a third conduit to draw the water. So, quote, about 55% of Nevada, already the nation's driest state, is under extreme or exceptional drought. And so they're asking now that people reduce their use of water. And they have. The region reduced daily use by 4.6% per person to 124 gallons. And so that's, they're probably going to have to reduce it to about 60 gallons. So here's the long-term perspective. If you enjoy the fountains and gambling and looking at celebrities, I guess Las Vegas is a good place to go. They ought to put a monument to Wayne Newton's hairdo. I have no idea why anybody likes Las Vegas. I can't stand the place. But I know a lot of other people do, and good for them if they enjoy it. But better enjoy it now, because Las Vegas is going to run out of water, and they're not going to have any place to get it, especially the people living in it, because you know who's going to get the water, the hotels, the gambling casinos, not the million-plus people living around it. I told you already about the ultraviolet radiation, and that's because the extreme ultraviolet radiation levels that are already occurring around the globe due to the ongoing climate engineering, and many in academia flatly disputed that this would be a serious issue. Well, now they've been shown to be wrong. Finally, confirmation has come from a peer review report. According to Geoengineering Watch, quote, the science media gatekeepers have not let any significant information out about the Northern Hemisphere ozone catastrophe, but they won't be able to hide the unfolding cataclysm for much longer. Though the authors of the study article suggest that the lethal ultraviolet radiation levels may have just been the result of a perfect storm of circumstances, this is not the case. The Earth's ozone layer is being systematically ripped apart by the totally out-of-control geoengineering programs. No ozone layer, no life on Earth. It's that simple. From every conceivable direction, the climate engineers are pounding the nails into the collective coffins. So the research team in the U.S. and Germany has measured the highest levels of ultraviolet radiation ever recorded on the Earth's surface. The extraordinary ultraviolet fluxes observed in the Bolivian Andes, over 1,500 miles from the equator, are far above those normally considered to be harmful to both terrestrial and aquatic life. The results are being published in the Frontiers Environmental Science Journal. Quote, these record-setting levels were not measured in Antarctica, where ozone holes have been a reoccurring problem for decades. And this according to leader of the team, Nathalie Cabral, of the CITE Institute and NASA's Ames Research Center. Quote, this is in the tropics, in an area where there are small towns and villages. The measurements were made in the southern hemisphere. So for those of you thinking about moving to South America, Central America, I'd say think again. Not going to be habitable there. Not a good idea. I'll keep you posted on this and what you could likely expect when it's going to really get bad, but it'll be overnight. I mean, who knew? At levels of 11 of ultraviolet background is considered dangerous. That means that people who fly airplanes, pilots, flight attendants, and passengers on a regular basis, now you're going to get a lot more background radiation. Then when you hit the ground and you're out in the sun, you're going to get the ultraviolet radiation. So we have to start looking at the problem and come up with solutions. And, of course, we will be there to give you both of those. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come back. I'm going to do a follow-up challenge to a filmmaker who has made a very well-made film technically. It's easy to watch. Lots of reenactments of history, of the Civil War, Revolutionary War, Indian times, and if you're not a very strong history person, you come away thinking, wow, really important film. But there's another perspective to it. The film is called America. I suggest you see it just because you've got to know what kind of propaganda machine the neocons have. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I fell asleep late last night, and I dreamed that the night and almost half the day away. I just got up so that I could hear her say she's still in love and no one could take her love away. Ooh, love wakes me up every day, and I thought no one could ever make me feel this way. It fills me up every time I hear her say she's still in love.
Approximately 10 minutes from now, we'll go to our conference phone to speak with Professor Sheldon Krimsky for a continuation of our series on conversations with remarkable minds. He will tell us about the deceptions behind GMOs and why food and chemical companies and government agencies are putting families and the environment at risk. This is a part of our series of environmental and public health issues, a call to action, and informing the public about what's wrong with our food. But now I want to talk about what's wrong with people's perceptions. There is a man, Dinesh D'Souza, D-S-O-U-S-A. He's the new president of the city's only evangelical college. And he has got quite a background. I didn't know much about him. And then I found out that he wrote a book called The Roots of Obama's Rage, which was, like many of his books, it was a bestseller, but also even the very conservative Weekly Standard lamented the book's misstatements of fact, leaps in logic, and pointlessly elaborate argumentation. He produced this documentary, and in it he highlighted several things. For example, he highlighted American exceptionalism. He highlighted the fact that slavery and taking away the land of the Native Americans, that didn't really happen. He tried to show that Native Americans were taking each other's land and holding each other in slavery, and that you just needed to realize how exceptional you were to rise above all this and become prosperous, and that the most benevolent people were the wealthiest. He gave an example of T. Boone Pickens, one of the corporate raiders, as an example. He emphasized how capitalism and free market ideology is what really brings us all up and helps us and will save the day. And he had a gentleman from India talking about how India's culture has thrived and China's culture has thrived. They mentioned both 200 to 400 million people, 200 to 250 million people in India. Upwards of 400 million people in China now have vastly more, pleasant lifestyles, more income, more consumer things. And that we really have never been after land, and the signers' Declaration of Independence were very spiritual people. And kind of this idea of that if you're a good Christian and then you want your government to follow the laws of Christianity. And I went through a lot of this and deconstructed his views on Christopher Columbus and other things yesterday. First of all, many journalists and scholars have commented on the lack of any acknowledgement of Christianity, God, or Jesus in the Constitution. It clearly bars all laws, quote, respecting the establishment of religion. The only reference the religious right has to draw upon is the single reference to the Creator in the Declaration of Independence. But then the question is, what kind of Creator and from which religion, philosophy, or belief does the Creator originate? And this points directly to what has been called deism, which also has been usurped by the Christian right and reinterpreted into distinctly Christian terms to support the ideological claims that the United States government and Christianity belong together, joined at the hip. So I would appreciate if he would take the time to actually study this and show me, show anyone, where this is a part of our Constitution, which he refers to constantly. Deism had more in common with philosophical nature mysticism and the role of reason over blind faith than it does anything in the Bible. And finally, the Treaty of Tripoli. A treaty signed by the United States and the Ottomans in 1797 states, quote, "The government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of against the laws, religion, or tranquility of the Muslimin," end quote. At the time, the statement was printed on the front page of newspapers around the world with no outcry from the American churches or population. What really concerned me was that he really supports capitalism. Okay, I don't believe we should be supporting capitalism. I believe we should be supporting what I call ethical commerce. I'd like to get away from the terms capitalism because they're meaningless. You could have a person who has their own business, works ethically, supports at the best they can their employees, and gives a service to their community. And he tries to juxtapose, look at these small business people, look at this tavern owner. But he doesn't position that against what it means today to be a capitalist. That person is in commerce. You own a restaurant, you own a hair salon, you own a fruit market, you own a dog walking service. Are you going to try to compare that to one of the national mall stores that's overtaking the Upper West Side of Manhattan, everywhere else, where small ethical businesses have been forced out because they can't pay the exorbitant rents? Are you going to compare them to Apple? That's what you try to say, that all you need is look at capitalism. No. But what you don't say in your film and needs to be said is the following, that you are against welfare, and you make that clear in your film. You think that people are simply lazy and need to be more motivated. And I'm saying that the corporate entity of capitalism today, the thousands that exist, are only in place in the majority of cases because they have manipulated the system. They have created massive debt, and they live through debt. Now, one of the people you had on the program was T. Boone Perkins, along with Carl Icahn and Michael Milken and Ivan Botsky and Saul Steinberg, were the originators of the concept of junk bonds and green mail or green blackmail, buying shares in the company and then they give you a bonus to go away, or taking over a company, stripping off its assets. Why didn't you mention that the reason we have Detroit and Stockton and Compton and a thousand other small and larger communities in the United States that look bankrupt or are bankrupt and are rotted out is not because we have lazy people unwilling to be motivated, but because you outsourced over the last 35 years about 25 to 30 million jobs, and those jobs which have been there for about 40 years giving gainful employment and quality of life and good commerce within the local community with for good schools and good maintenance, those are gone. And not a thought about this. You didn't mention debt. I will. Economic Policy Institute estimates the total of $121 billion in executive compensation was deductible from corporate earnings from just 3 years, 2007-2010. That means the CEOs from the top six junk food chains pocketed over $181 million, fully deductible as performance pay. We are paying that then. Yuma Brands, Taco Bell, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Pizza Hut got the largest taxpayer subsidy For CEOs, $94 million. McDonald's CEO James Skinner set a record, received $31 million or $14 million in taxpayer subsidies. The Environmental Working Group last year estimates that the federal government gave $11.3 million in taxpayer farm subsidies to 50 billionaires and businesses, and many of them, like Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen and investment titan Charles Schwab. Why should we be giving them? And how much did this all come to? How much did we give these people? $316 billion. Another report shows that state and local government subsidies compiled by Good Jobs First Subsidy Tracker gave $110 billion last year to less than 1,000 big corporations. Boeing, $13.2 billion. Alcoa, $5.6 billion. Intel, $3.9 billion. General Motors, $3.5 billion. Ford, $2.5 billion. Dow Chemical, $1.4 billion. Why should we be giving any of these companies any subsidies? That's welfare for the rich. Why aren't you concerned about welfare for the rich? Why didn't you mention you're concerned about welfare for everyone else? You want to see everyone else have the quality of their life affected by squeezing. Why didn't you mention debt? Today, the only reason most of these corporations exist at all, your friends, the people that you're the cheerleader for in your documentary, America, is because we, the people, we didn't get a break. When the crash came and the bubbles were being formed, we didn't form any bubbles. The American public never formed a bubble. We were stupid enough to trust the people in power. Big mistake. They formed the bubbles. The Federal Reserve formed the bubbles. The banks formed the bubbles. The Department of Commerce saw the bubbles. Everyone on the inside was making money through liar's loans, manipulating the system. But when the bubble burst, they immediately were bailed out. A total of $20 trillion they were given. We weren't giving anything. We've had 5.4 million homes taken, averaging four people per home. That's 20 million people put on the street. No forgiveness for you. We had people who were forced into bankruptcy. No forgiveness for you. We are people who can't afford both their food and medicine and rent and whatever else they're paying. No forgiveness for you. Instead, we allowed, through Senator Dodd from Connecticut, to pass one of the stupidest amendments, laws ever, the Dodd-Frank Amendment of law, and we allowed Wall Street to control our bankruptcy laws. Now, if you're a student, you can't get out of your bankruptcy through bankruptcy for your student debt. How much is our debt? We keep hearing Sean Hannity and other people who are so misinformed tell us the national debt. It's $17.5 trillion. Really? Is that it? Is that your level of scholarship and knowledge about debt and finances? Excuse me, Sean and Bill and the rest of you over at Fox. Let me give you actual figures. U.S. federal spending, $3.5 trillion. State debt, $1.2 trillion. Local debt, at $1.8 trillion. The interest paid, $2.5 trillion. Personal debt, $16 trillion. Mortgage debt, $13 trillion. Student debt, $1.2 trillion. Credit card debt, $890 billion. Social Security liability, $16 trillion. U.S. unfunded liability, $121 trillion. And corporate debt, $26 trillion. And on top of all that, the major corporations that you're sponsoring, you're supporting, you're cheerleading for, they would have been out of business. They would have been bankrupt. So what would you have said if 90% of the top banks in the United States and corporations had to go out of business and go bankrupt? Your fiscal model of trickle down wouldn't have looked so relevant. The fact is, it's all been held together by the control over the financial system. And now they're holding $400 trillion in derivatives. You didn't talk about that either. And you didn't talk about unemployment, real unemployment numbers. You didn't talk about the fact the U.S. is now spending 26% of available tax revenue to pay interest. That's a fact. I'll get into that on another show. You didn't talk about the tax dodging, that we have $31 trillion sitting in offshore accounts by these same corporations. Well, if you really love America and you keep showing us Mount Rushmore and the Statue of Liberty, then why aren't you condemning these corporations for holding $31 trillion offshore, not paying fair taxes? Small businesses have to pay their taxes. Homeowners have to pay their taxes. They don't. So if you're against the 35% tax, then give them an amnesty. Let them pay 20% of what they're holding out off and bring the rest back and let them keep it. That gives us a nice chunk of change to pay down debt. Why don't we forgive all of our outstanding interest on the debt in any case, because it's all math that is made up? Why don't we kick them off the U.S. stock indices, bar them from being able to sell their stocks, such as Standard & Poor's 500? Why don't we give a tax disclosures, let the public know how many companies did not pay taxes? Give a flat tax for every corporation. You can't deduct it. You can't get out of it, no matter how expensive your tax attorney. So that is what we didn't hear from you. Also, I don't have time today. I will deal with the worst of the worst, the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership between the U.S. and the European Union. They plan to create the world's largest free trade area. It's all based upon over 500 of the top lobbyists from the top corporations wanting to protect investment and remove what they consider all unnecessary regulatory barriers. That means their treaty, signed by our president, ratified by our Congress, would destroy all of our unions, all of our environmental laws, and allow IBM, the Chamber of Commerce in the United States, General Motors, Toyota, the members who are a part of this, to have no downside to this. So that's what you're not seeing in the movie. I've never seen such a bad piece of propaganda as the movie I just mentioned. Now let's go to my guest, who is standing by, because I want to have time to get into this issue. He is, as I mentioned earlier and gave his background, Professor Sheldon Krimsky, and his research is focused on the linkages between science, technology, ethics, and public policy, with an emphasis on the bioethics of genetic engineering. He is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and served on the National Institutes of Health Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee from 1978 to 1981, and has been a consultant to the Presidential Commission for the Study of Ethical Problems in Medicine and Biomedical Research, and to the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment. He authored 13 books and 190 scientific papers and reviews. They've appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Nature, Nature Genetics, Nature Biotechnology, Internal Medicine, American Scientists, and Science. His most recent book is The DNA Deception, What You Need to Know About the Food, Corporations, and Government Agencies Putting Our Families and the Environment at Risk, co-written by Jeremy Gruber and a foreword by Ralph Nader. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
When we review all the literature and arguments over the GMO debate regarding its true safety and value, we find multiple camps. When the early GMO labeling effort in California and Washington were underway, the main argument from GMO proponents was the right to know what is in our food. That was primarily their sole message. In my opinion, it was utterly lame and contributed to the defeat of the bills at the poll because it ignored the science that challenges Monsanto and the food industry over the health and environmental safety of GMOs. This message is no match for the PR machine of Big Ag and Big Food. So please lay out what you observe as the battlefield underway, the main players involved over the GMO debate, and then segue in that into, you've had a long career in academia of over 30 years. Speak on the current challenges anti-GMO advocates are facing to get the independent science showing the health risk of GMO and pesticides such as Roundup communicated to the public. The forum is yours.
Well, okay. Let me start historically. Some of us remember Dan Quayle. He headed a commission to evaluate and make recommendations about the regulation of biotechnology. So by 1992, after he left office, the results of his work came to fruition. And at that time, the FDA made a decision that it was not going to treat genetically engineered food the way it treats, let's say, chemicals put into food. In other words, foreign genes would not be considered a food additive. In addition to that, they said the primary responsibility for the regulation of GM crops and seeds would be on the developers. And they gave them a guidance document, you might say, which said, you know, if you find any problems, come see us, and we'll tell you what to do. That's essentially what happened in 1992. The Europeans did not accept that, and they passed regulations that said that they have to evaluate and test the products that were coming out on the market. So with that historical setting, we then fast forward and we find that currently there seems to be three positions, that you can cluster three positions in the scientific community. And I've spent most of my career trying to understand and to use science adequately in making decisions, public policy decisions. So I'm invested in science as probably the best way we have to fix our beliefs. There are other ways we can do it. We can create myths if we want, but I feel much more a kinship with good science than I do with any other methods for determining our belief system. So anyway, there are the beliefs about GMOs cluster into three camps. One camp is a group of scientists and others who say there is absolutely no reason to test these products. Once we know where the gene came from and where it's going to, that's all we need to know. And all the people who are concerned about this are Luddites or irrational. And it's surprising how many people fall into this camp and how many liberal-leaning publications fall into this camp. And even, you know, good scientists who fall into this camp. The second camp are people who say, hold it a minute. You cannot say a priori, you can't say definitively that any product you make is automatically going to be safe unless it's tested. Therefore, we have to come up with some reasonable ways to evaluate these products, you know, animal tests, et cetera, for various safety conditions, various environmental conditions, et cetera. And the Europeans, for the most part, are engaged, at least in theory, in this way of thinking. And there are groups of scientists who advocate this in their scientific papers. And then there's a third group that says, you know, we've done some studies. We actually have some studies. And some of them show adverse consequences of feeding GM crops to animals. And we've got to make something out of this. We've got to evaluate this. We've got to replicate this if we can. We can't just push this in the drawer and let it disappear. And that's what I that's the reason for putting out the GMO deception. Because there's information out there, reputable information, that's been pushed aside, that's been pushed in the drawers, and where you know, people just make claims as if this information doesn't exist. So that's really where we're at now, and these different sectors don't really talk to each other. They talk among themselves for the most part. And we've seen some situations where scientists who have done reputable work and found adverse consequences of feeding GMOs to animals, they've been vilified, they've been negated. In some cases, they've been pushed out of the city that they were working in. In one case, one researcher was pushed out of Scotland, essentially, fired from his job. And in a recent case, a French scientist was vilified so badly that the journal had retracted his paper, even though there was they admitted there was no fraud and there was no mistakes in the paper. They simply retracted it on the grounds that it was not definitive, which would probably cause the retraction of 90% of what's published. So we're seeing a very peculiar kind of political response to honest inquiries into whether or not the products of genetically modified crops are safe or not safe.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. You may have read recently how Hillary Clinton, during the large bio conference in San Diego, donned the role of an advertising consultant for the GMO company, suggesting they change their language. Instead of focusing on genetic engineered component of GM seeds, rather she advised them to focus on the positive contributions these seeds offer. Her example was to instruct them to, quote, drought-tolerant crops, say that, instead of genetically modified plants, although no such drought-tolerant GMO has been marketed yet. And, of course, Hillary and her husband, Bill Clinton, have been expertly mentored in erroneous advertising and propaganda spin for some time. Burston Marsteller, who has represented the worst of the worst corporations and dictatorial regimes in the cases such as Exxon Valdez, the Bhopal disaster, the Indonesian president's massacre of East Timor citizens, a criminal dictator, General Velada in Argentina, Monsanto, and its early BGH propaganda, and so others. So Bernstein Marsteller executives have held high positions throughout the Clinton presidency and were Hillary's chief campaign advisors during her Senate presidential runs. So what do you say from the standpoint of ethics when we find our elected politicians so enmeshed with certain corporations and industries whose technologies pose dire or possible long-term health and environmental risks?
Well, you're one of the best at discovering the interlocking relationships between politicians and corporations. And I think it's extremely important that those become transparent. And as we know, politicians often get their campaign money from sources that they become beholden to. And it would be a great thing if we had independent politicians, if we had public financing of campaigns so politicians did not have to be beholden to corporate sources. And yet, that's not the worst of it. It's not the worst of it because the politicians, while they make our laws, they don't produce our science. The worst of it are the conflicts of interest between the corporations and the people who produce our knowledge. Because once you have control over the knowledge, there's nothing left, really. So one of the things that I have found in my own investigations from some of the honest scientists who are reporting on this is that most of the studies on the safety of GMOs for human consumption, for animal consumption, are done by scientists who are funded by corporations. And there are a few review articles that actually state that. They say, well, you know, we've been doing the research on this and we're reviewing the literature, and I have to say that, you know, there's a body of research that says it's safe, and then there's articles that say it's not. But most of the research that says it's safe is coming from corporations. And that really requires a very careful analysis. I did some of the earliest studies on conflicts of interest in science, and it began to change the attitudes of the journals so that they now, most of the best journals, require a disclosure of conflicts of interest so that we know who is beholden to whom. If you heard about a safe cigarette in a scientific article and then you realized it was funded by a tobacco company, most people I know wouldn't even look at it. I mean, that's the attitude they have about the tobacco industry and what they try to do with manufacturing their own science. So I appreciate what you say about politicians, and it's really important that we understand where they're getting their funding from and why they're saying the things that they're saying. But they're not the experts. They're not the scientific experts. And if they support the GMOs, you know, that's fine. You know, we could probably figure out why they're doing it. But they're probably not reading the scientific literature. And that's what we really have to depend upon. We have to depend upon the best knowledge we have. And that's what the book tries to do. It tries to expose for the reader the honest information that we have that's available out there, that's independently produced by scientists who don't have a financial interest, financial stake in any of these outcomes.
I appreciate the input, and I know that you are a very important voice for those who want the truth about GMOs, especially since some polls show as high as 90% of the American public want labeling. If a food's been GMO created, they want to know it, so they have a choice of buying it or not buying it. And so we need more people informed, and one way to be informed about the GMO issue is the book GMO Deception, What You Need to Know About the Food Corporations and Government Agencies Putting Our Families and Environment at Risk, by my guest, Professor Sheldon Krimsky, K-R-I-M-S-K-Y. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I'm Gary Knoll, and that's important that we keep sharing the information on GMOs. And just as an aside, I took a look this morning at, The War on Health, the documentary, because if you don't do it that way, then you get everything. It's on war and health. But if you do War on Health documentary, then it shows you on Google every single one for like 12 pages. It is the film, and it had, I think, 78 million search results. A lot of people are watching. We had about, I think, 12 million today alone on Seeds of Death, the documentary. So share the information that you hear on this program. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. And this just in from our positive news segment. Rachel is a woman from New Jersey, and she said to me that in the recent issue of Elle magazine, this is one of these fashion magazines that I only read these like when I'm waiting to get my hair cut or something. There's a whole spread on the importance of using things like Manuka honey, apple cider vinegar, activated charcoal, and coconut oil as part of your beauty routine. And they have everything organic. And I was very, very impressed. I got the magazine, I read the article, and it's a 5-page spread on natural things. So, I mean, the information's getting out there. All I can imagine is the editors of the magazine must be listening to your show, because a lot of the stuff is the stuff that you've discussed on your programs about the health benefits of Manuka honey, apple cider vinegar, activated charcoal, and an organic coconut oil.
I really am not concerned how they get it. I am concerned that they do. At the end of the day, it's not who creates the information. It is who uses it. And we have to begin just to share. That's why I said a moment ago, share as much as you can about what you learn. Are you at your computer now?
I am.
Google the War on Health documentary, because I want to see what it is now. Because this has just been consistently all over the world. And then you wonder, how come you got people listening in 166 countries? It's the internet. I see. What are they interested in? Health. Well, how'd they learn about your show? You know, you don't advertise. You have no publicity. The internet. Documentaries. Films. Articles. You know, investigative reports. White papers.
Yeah, it's all over. It's all over the
what is the number when you Google War on Health documentary? The number will be right. The search results will be right under the title on the left-hand side.
I'm looking here.
And this is how we share. So share that information. Share the War on Health, the documentary, with as many people as possible. Do you find it there, Luann?
I don't see it here on what's coming up for Google.
Okay. All right. Well, then maybe on your server you don't have it. In any case, we look forward...
Oh, wait a second. Here we are. I've got 255,965.
That's not what I have.
No?
No. I'm doing it myself right now. The war on health... let's see.
That's just for the YouTube downloads.
No, the YouTube, that's just my downloads, and that's just today.
Okay.
I'm doing the War on Health, the documentary. Okay, here's the number as of right now. 58,600,000, and every single one of them is the film. You just go page after page after page.
There you go.
So that's what people, that's how we're networking worldwide. Sharing films, articles, calls to action, books, conversations. So that's why I say, don't just come and listen to a program or download an article. Share it with someone else. That's how we, the people, become more empowered. Thanks a lot, Luann.
Okay.
Let's go over and say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary, and hi, Luann. I'm getting a feedback. I don't know why. But today is Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, and listeners take the conversation wherever they want it to go.
Great. Okay. Right now, let's listen. And by the way, if you have a chance to watch this film, America, see if you can sit there with what you know now, and then as you're seeing propaganda coming at you, well-done propaganda, I might mention. It's beautifully done. See if you now can separate out fact from mind control. Okay? Have a nice day, everyone. I'll see you Sunday night, 8 o'clock. A lot of good material coming at you then.